I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is science writer Mary Roach, whose new book is Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal. She's joined in conversation by author and journalist Jack Bulwer. And now join Brian Garrick on stage at the JCCSF as he introduces Mary Roach and Jack Bulwer.
The Washington Post has called Mary Roach America's funniest science writer. In her previous books, she has tackled subjects like the afterlife in Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, brought us answers to the questions Dr. Ruth never asked in Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, and explored the universe of zero gravity in Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. Mary applies her trademark wit and candor to taboo in her latest book, Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal, which discusses everything you wanted and everything you never wanted to know about digestion. The New York Times has said, Gulp is far and away her funniest and most sparkling book, bringing Ms. Roach's love of weird science to material that could not have more everyday relevance. Having graduated from Corpses, The Afterlife, and Sex, she tacks on a subject wholly mainstream. She explores it with unalloyed merriment, and she is fearless about the embarrassment that usually accompanies it. Joining Mary on stage is the equally hilarious and sharp-witted Jack Bulwer. So without further ado, please welcome Mary and Jack to the stage.
If you had picked up the New York Times today, you would realize that, of course, Mary Roach's book Gulp on the bestseller list. Number two, first week on the list. So before we start talking about Mary's new book, we've actually known each other a long time. And I remember one of the first times I met Mary, she asked me, well, what are you working on? And I said, well, I'm writing about sumo wrestling in the Czech Republic. And this is a classic Mary Roach response. You said, oh, sumo wrestling. Oh, make sure to talk about the guys that are so fat they have to have an assistant to wipe their ass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
No, that's
it's true.
And I think that combines a lot of Mary Roach in that response. It's insanely gross. It's funny. There's some scientific, you know, physics involved. And there's a bit of travel. So
that's right.
I think that all worked out really well. Given that you love, this inappropriate science, I wanted to see, you know, when you were a child, you grew up in New Hampshire.
New Hampshire.
New Hampshire.
Yes, sir.
Were you the type of kid, I'm guessing here, that you would come to the dinner table and say, hey, everybody, I just ate a maggot. I mean, were you like, you know, did you have a love of the visceral as a child?
Curiously enough, my dad was a pretty easygoing guy, but the one thing he would not abide was belches or farts, particularly at the dinner table. You would be spanked.
Wow.
You would be spanked.
Tough
so,
love.
Yeah. And also, you weren't allowed to swear.
Wow.
Yeah.
So where did your sort of love of, you know, this kind of information develop then? Were your parents interested in science?
No. My dad was a theater guy. My dad was a speech and theater, and my mom was a secretary. But people have asked me this before, and I do have some memories. Like, I didn't have dolls. I had little dinosaurs from the Natural History Museum. And someone gave me at one point a Barbie doll. The only time I had a doll, and what I did with it was I would pull the head off and give myself 10 seconds to get the head back on or she dies. So,
wow.
Which, if you've read Stiff, is actually kind of accurate.
Wow.
Basically,
10-second rule. Yeah.
10-second rule.
Right.
Yeah, you're on, you know, you wow. could still survive that.
That's nice. No Ken dolls, then just a Barbie.
It was just a Barbie, yeah, with wow. a black perm.
And nice, nice. So you're what gave you the sense that you wanted to be a writer? Why did you move to San Francisco? You had it all.
Yeah.
New Hampshire. You had it all. You had a mini Ivy League school.
Yes. The little three.
We feel so sorry for you. Yeah.
It's almost an Ivy League.
So you could have had it all.
I graduated and I didn't have any plans. I was a liberal arts major. I don't have a science background, and I had no job skills. And 1981, when I graduated, was a pretty severe recession.
Right.
So I had nothing going on. I did a drive-away car. I don't know if drive-away cars still exist, where people, trusting stupid people, would give their cars over to college students who would
go across the United States,
right. Trash them.
Right.
Try to,
and then you'd never have to return it. You just return it at wherever you arrived, right? Wasn't that it?
Somebody had flown cross country with their belongings or whatever,
right.
And you and your buddies would take this car cross country and then deliver it, trying to sort of glue the rearview mirror back on and clean it up as best you could. And
that's what brought you to the West Coast.
I came out with some friends who were going to Berkeley that summer, and I.
Berkeley,
dude. I heard someone said, "Oh, San Francisco. There's this thing called dim sum, where they wheel around a cart with these amazing, weird foods." And that was the most exotic thing to me at the time.
Wow.
I think I came out here for dim sum.
Nice. And then, of course, you learn after a while. You learn that the rude wave, if you don't want it in a dim sum restaurant, if somebody brings you, like,
yeah.
I love
exactly.
That. Yeah,
the
exactly.
Rude wave.
So you'd finished school, and we're at Lickwake. We do this thing called Regretterature, a show every year, and we ask people to come in and read from the worst stuff they've ever written. And Mary did the show last year, and it was a piece. I think it was one of the first things you'd ever have published.
Yes,
and it was.
I had a job in the PR office of the SPCA in San Francisco.
In San Francisco,
and part of my duty was to write. It was a column that was in the Examiner called Pet Tips. Pet Tips.
Anybody remember
Pet Tips? No, probably not.
Not one.
Quite a while ago. Anyway, and I read from a Pet Tips column called Guppy Love.
Yeah.
Which was
Guppy Love.
Encouraging people to not use guppies as feeders for other fish, but to raise them as pets.
Right.
It's trying to make the case that guppies were a fascinating pet.
Right. All by themselves.
I wish I could remember the first line.
I remember the last line. Let's hear it for guppies.
Yeah. That's right. So let's hear. I think it was one of those. I got to wind this up. I got to end this somehow. Okay. So let's hear it for guppies.
Guppies. Yay. Guppies.
Yeah, guppies. But the thing is, I saved that clip for many. I was proud. At that period of time, that represented, I was proud of that clip.
Yeah.
I started below the bottom of the ladder. The first thing I wrote was for not even a newspaper, but the fake advertising supplement that, Home Safety, which is basically just a way to sell advertising to burglar alarm companies and German Shepherd training companies. And then it would be filled with horrible, cheesy, unpaid writing. And I wrote one piece that for some advertising supplement, and I remember showing my roommates. I lived in the corner of Haight and Ashbury, showing them, "Look, I'm published.
I'm a writer."
I was proud of that.
Wow!
But if you start at the bottom, there's nowhere to go but up. So everything is always good.
I feel sorry for people who start at the top.
I do too.
It's just.
I do too.
They're terrible.
It's a scourge.
After a while, you started writing travel stuff. That's, I think, is when I first met you. You were flying all over the place, and one magazine even put you on the cover, and it was the Tomato Festival somewhere in Europe. And it was you on the cover, splattered with tomatoes.
Yeah. There's a festival called La Tomatina, which is this little town in Spain where the tomatoes, I guess they have a surplus because these tanker trucks come in with tomatoes and they unload them into the streets of this little town.
Right.
And it's a massive tomato fight. And at the end of it, there is the streets are that deep in pulp.
Mush.
It's mush. And yeah. and you, anything goes. Oh, no, no. You have to crush them in your hand first because some of them are a little unripe. They don't want anybody to get hurt. But anyway.
Right.
The tomato.
No, I remember thinking, wow, they put the writer on the cover of this magazine. That's, of they course, did, my yeah. perspective. Like, geez. Wow, pretty cool.
It was a little hard to wreck. I was lying down, almost submerged in tomato pulp. So
yeah,
I think
yeah. It could have been
it
anybody.
It could have been anybody.
That's true. That's true. So when you did your first book, Stiff, I read recently that you were kind of challenged to do a book.
Yeah, that book. Well, I.
It's your first book with a classic opening line about.
The human head is the same approximate size and weight as a roaster chicken, I think was the first line in that book.
Something like that, right.
Because the heads were in roaster pans at the time. People are going, what? What?
This thing just disintegrated. It seemed to be going
so
well.
Suddenly the heads were in roaster. It was a plastic surgery practice session, and each person who had paid the amount of money to go and learn these techniques had a head, and they put them in a... the kind of thing you would put a roaster chicken, you'd pick it up at the Walgreens or whatever, aluminum, because they're about the same size.
Right.
Anyway, where were we going?
Let's see.
Okay, yes,
that genesis
book
of the book
grew out of, yeah, I wrote that book partly because I used to be in the Grotto, as you you know.
San Francisco Writer's Grotto,
and three of us there would go every New Year's, we'd go out to lunch and make predictions for the next year, where people would be, personal life, career. And someone made a prediction for me that I would have a book contract. And so fast forward to October, and I realized, you know, that in a few months we're going to go to lunch and we're going to read through the list of predictions from the previous year. And someone would go, oh, Mary Roach, no, doesn't have a book contract. So I thought, okay, I've got 2 months. So I did it to out of a desire to avoid a humiliating lunch.
It was fear that drove you to put your first book
basically
together.
And around the same time I got a fortune cookie fortune that said try something new. That also, it was that random.
Wow.
It was that random in a conversation with an agent around that time. I was writing a column for Salon.com, and he said, well, what columns got the highest hit rates? And there were a couple of cadaver
death,
research
right.
related.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it happened. Pretty, just fairly random. Not, wow. It's not like it was a lifetime interest of mine, which people assume with your first book that you are writing not because you are trying to make a living as a writer, but because of a passion
right.
to surround yourself in
I
this.
I just love cadavers.
I just, all I want to do.
All the time.
My whole life I wanted to write about cadavers. and that's what people think.
Right, but after two or three years, you're like, okay, got it with the cadavers. Let's see what else is out there.
Yeah.
One of the things that's interesting about your books, and I love them all. I haven't read them all, but I love them all. Is that...
You like the, the covers?
I read most of them. there's this fascination that I see you have with, first of all, facts. Lovely facts. Some of the most amazing facts
but
that have ever been.
But only special facts.
But they're facts that you, I would think as you stumble upon them in your research, you'd want to tell someone right away.
Yeah, right.
And do you do that or do you bottle it up and wait for the book to come out?
I bottle it. I do. I bottle it up. And I just have this desire for it to kind of be fresh. I don't know why. If I tell someone, they're going to remember that 2 or 3 years down the line. Read through it. Oh, I knew that. I mean, nobody's going to remember, but I have this sense of wanting it to be. Because particularly now with the internet, I feel like it's so hard to find material that hasn't, if it's interesting or funny or whatever it is, you sort of have to assume it's out there on the internet. So when I find something that's not, that seems sort of fresh and special, I kind of like guard it try to keep it fresh and then spring it upon the public when the book comes out.
No one will know this. Another thing that I think is fascinating is that you interview a lot of scientists in all of your books. You make pilgrimages to these experts in their fields, and you're kind of making them famous in a way, but there also is this unsuppressed glee I see in your writing where you're like, I'm following, you know, someone in a manure patch and we're going to, you know, milk a goat or we're going to poke a dead body or something, and there's just something you know, I don't know. I think that's part of the joy of your books is this glee.
Yeah,
don't you feel
I
that
think
way?
That, oh, yeah, for sure. And but it's a mix. Some of the scientists are just awed that anybody wants to be there in the lab. For example, in Gulp, I spent some time in the with some researchers who do. It's a very small sliver of science called oral processing, mm-hmm. and it has to do with what goes on in your mouth when you are forming a bolus. To, you know, you're creating, you take food apart and then you reform it into the swallowable state. And then, so there's this all, there's people who did the unbelievable level of detail that's gone into studying this. These people do not expect an email saying, I'd like to travel all the way to the Netherlands to come to your lab. They're not accustomed to this. And sometimes they're frightened and other times they're delighted. And then there are people like Michael Levitt, who is the flatus expert. This man has,
Right. Okay,
he's published 34 papers on flatus. He started out, it was as a resident, and he said, when I was a resident, the gas chromatograph had just come into use, and no one had yet applied it. No one had had the idea or the nerve, I guess you could say, to apply it to human flatus.
Right.
So his advisor said, well, I think you should do this because you're kind of an incompetent, and this way at least it'll be new and you'll get it published. And he did. He had papers on flatulence in New England Journal of Medicine.
Right.
34 papers. But then at a certain point, Michael Levitt got very tired of being associated with farts.
Yeah.
And
that was a sad day for science when he did.
And he moved on, and he's like, when you go to see Michael Levitt, you go
is
to...
Is he still involved in the study of flatus?
No, he's not, but he made the mistake of agreeing to see me when I had to email him 3 or 4 times.
Right. Because he's the king of flatus.
He's the king of flatus.
And you have to talk to him.
And if you go on, at one point I couldn't remember what he looked like, if he had gray hair or red hair, and so I wrote in Google Images, I put Michael Levitt, and... this is true. In Google Images, one of the first images was a can of baked beans.
That's his legacy. He's stuck with it.
Yeah, he's done all. And so you go to see him, and he goes, "You know, I've done a lot of other work. You know, I invented the breath hydrogen test, and I've done a lot of work with the villi, the small intestine and intestinal stirring, and which helps with absorption of nutrients." And so I'm like, and I asked a requisite number of questions about intestinal stirring, and then I said,
"By the way,
do you think we could see the mylar flatus trapping pantaloons, which he had invented and had made these?"
These are pants that would trap gas. For later study.
For study. Because if you're going to study flatus, you have to trap it.
You have to catch it at its moment.
You have to catch it. Yes, it's a fleeting thing, and you've got to somehow trap it. And mylar is airtight, so...
Mylar. So what color are these pants?
They're like tinfoil color. It looks... There's a photograph. He couldn't find them. This killed me. I'm like, I went all the way to Minneapolis, and you can't find the...
You're the king of farts.
Flatus trapping.
Like, prominently displayed in his office.
Yeah, so we looked through the storeroom for a while, and there's lots of interesting things down there, but not the mylar flatus trapping pantaloons, though he did produce a photograph from the 80s. It was a very 80s-looking picture of this woman with their kind of looked like tinfoil knickers.
Yeah. Kind of like a 80s MTV video, almost, in a way. It's very much of its time.
Yeah.
Today there would be maybe they'd have like snap button plaid, a little hipster. Anyway, where are we going?
Something
with
like
this?
That. Anyway, so Michael Levitt, he was nice enough to talk to me that afternoon, but then at a certain point he stopped returning my emails. I have no idea what he thought of the book. I think he's tired of it.
Yeah.
And now, of course, with this whole round of publicity for Gulp, his name is coming up over and over in relation to flatulence. Yes. And people are now I'm calling him, I'm sure, again.
So what?
It's like, Mary Roach.
I'm not the fart king anymore.
Intestinal stirring. Ask me about that.
Do you get what is the blowback from the science community after your books come out?
It's funny because blowback is actually.
I didn't. I swear to God, wasn't
term.
Thinking.
If you're trying to use one like a flatulence odor reducing cushion, you get rectal gas. Oh, it's blow. It's yeah. Blow.
Blowback.
Blow by.
Blow by.
Yeah.
Good to know, though. Yeah, it's good to have.
It's good. Anyway, sorry. What?
Anyway, no. Yeah. the after effect of your book's publication and what that does to the characters, because you make your most people when they write a book, they're like, okay, I interviewed the scientist, I get the facts I need, and I continue on with my narrative. They're characters in your books.
Yeah, right.
You get to see what they look like, what they eat for lunch. I mean, you know, any sort of like characteristics about them, they actually become part of the narrative. And you know, have you had nasty letters? Are they like all proud of, you know, being featured in your books?
Scientists are incredibly good-natured, mm-hmm. good sports for the most part.
Black humor.
I'm always nervous about, because I don't typically send the chapter for review. I'll sometimes go over facts with somebody that I've interviewed, but I don't usually give them the entire chapter to review, because that way madness lies. Yeah, you know, I thought we were going to, I was hoping you'd talk about, and I don't think I was wearing that, and, you know, people focus on things that they won't focus on when the book is out, and they see it, they're like, oh, I can deal with this is okay.
Right, but they saw just that chapter.
If they had the opportunity to make a lot of changes.
They would.
They would. They yeah. probably would. But I like to, in response to that question, my favorite reaction, there was for Spook, which was a book about people trying to use scientific method to investigate the soul or the afterlife. And there was a guy in India, a Dr. Rawat, and he was looking into cases of alleged reincarnation. He would go to little villages and talk to people who think that a small child is the reincarnation of somebody who died that same day. Anyway, so I sent the book to Dr. Rawat, and I got this lovely note back, because he's a poet also. And he said, Mary, your book is like a bouquet of roses, many flowers and leaves and a few thorns. So aww. I thought that was a lovely...
That's a great book blurb on the back of a book at some point. People, So when did you realize that this sort of was kind of your specialty? Was it after the first book? And then you realize, oh, all of my, you know, passions are kind of included in this. You know, eccentric scientists.
Right.
You know,
travel.
Travel, grisly, gross facts.
Yeah.
About something involving human body.
Well, it is kind of a. It seems to work for me. I think every time I do a book, I think, well, maybe I'll do some sort of a departure, and I'll do like more of a narrative, a sweeping narrative, or something more grown up, or something more less sciencey, and then
Spartacus by Mary Roach.
I just don't come up with those ideas. The ideas I come up with are, oh God, like Bonk was really the sex lab book was one day I was reading Film Quarterly of all things. I don't know how I came to be
very
reading.
Sexy.
Yeah, Film Quarterly, and there was a reference to the colposcopic films of Masters and Johnson, and I went, colposcopic, isn't that the cervix? And does this mean what I? And I looked up a little bit about Masters and Johnson, and lo and behold, they had made films using a plexiglass phallus so they could film the female sexual response from the inside of the body, which is in the 50s an extraordinary thing to do. And I remember exactly at that moment going, sex research, next book.
Here we go.
Just perfect. And then there's no heading back. So
wow. So do all of the books begin with a fact like that?
No. Sometimes it's I have a cluster of things I would like to write about. Like Gulp was really, there was a trip to Beano many years ago.
Right.
Beano.
Does everyone know what Beano is?
The drops that you put in your chili or your beans to break down these carbohydrates so that it doesn't happen in your colon, so you're less gassy.
Right. Okay. Anti-gas
drops. Right. So,
great name, though.
Beano. So I was at the Beano. Beano has a lab where they do flatulence research. So
do you have a years, gift shop?
Guess what?
No.
No, but the guy the guy who runs the place, Dr. Kligerman, gave me a Beano windbreaker.
Nice.
And I still have it.
Nice.
Yeah.
With their logo
yes,
on it?
Yes, Beano right here.
Nice.
Yeah.
Does it have your name on the other side?
No, it does not. It does not.
My name's Mary. I'm here to fix it.
Beano.
That's so great.
But they should have a gift.
So you're going to the Beano.
Okay, so
factory.
Beano, I had, and this was a story I did years ago, and I had all this really fun stuff, and I couldn't use it because my editor didn't share my sensibilities. and sense of humor. So I had this sort of sitting there, and then I also had some material from something I came across in Packing for Mars. And so I had a, sometimes what I do when I come up with a book is like, here are four things I'd like to play with. What would be the umbrella topic that could allow me to go there? So I kind of go back. I don't start with the idea. I start with the particulars. I'm really ass backward when it comes to my process and how I do books.
But whatever works. There is some spacesuit information in Gulp that is... I'm trying to think of... Is this what the fact was?
There's an activated charcoal filter in a spacesuit so that if the astronaut farts, it won't circulate past his nose every 10 seconds, which it otherwise would. So there's a way to trap that odor.
Right.
Is that what you're talking about?
So, I was thinking if you came across that fact and you had Beano research, it is kind of a natural connection.
It is, two. Well, in Packing for Mars, the zero gravity toilet chapter, I have to say I outdid myself with that. I took it to levels that even I did not think was possible. So, and that's the chapter everybody talked about.
Is that your favorite fact out of all the books?
What fact?
About the zero gravity toilet.
Oh, so many facts. So many facts in that. It was a lot of fun because it was, what I loved about it is it wasn't just a sort of a tee-hee topic. The people who do the waste management engineers at NASA are responsible for morale to a larger extent than anybody realizes. When that toilet goes out, the contingency plan on a space mission, if the toilet isn't working, is the old fecal bag, which is just a bag, really, with an adhesive ring, and you have to, because it's zero gravity and you're not going to have good separation, you got to, coaxing it. It's a horrible situation. So the people who make that toilet, and that's not easy to make a zero gravity toilet, a whole different principle, those people are contributing more than you would imagine to.
They're heroes.
They're
heroes of the space
Everybody
industry.
Everybody thinks the astronaut is the hero, but it's the waste management people who
Anyone
hold
Anyone can
the
be an
key.
Astronaut.
Yeah, that's right.
But can you design a toilet?
Toilet that's going to work without gravity.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So when you're at a dinner party, do these things come up?
No one invites me to dinner parties
anymore.
Don't bring her. No. Make her sit in the kitchen.
She's going to start talking about gross things.
Yeah. No, I don't. And often every now and then somebody invites me to either a breakfast event or a lunch event, and I'm always, you just see people putting down their silverware.
And you're like, you were on Terry Gross last week, two weeks ago?
Yes.
Or whenever this was, a fresh air. I don't know if I've ever heard Terry Gross talk about the difference between male and female farts.
That is
a direct, result of your research. And I could hear you on the other end. You were like completely laughing. You were just so happy that Terry Gross was kind of befuddled by the difference in the sexes of the
first latest. Of all, I've never been on Fresh Air in the 10 years I've been writing books, so just getting there was pretty spectacular. But getting Terry Gross to discuss that, and also there was part of the conversation had to do with a chapter in Gulp that's set at Avenal State Prison, which has to do with hooping, which is smuggling things through the hoop rectally. So I got to hear the classic, unmistakable Terry Gross voice saying, "So you spent some time with people who practice something called hooping." And I was just like, "This is really some kind of high point in my life." Just
it was. I'm sure it made her day.
She was a tremendously good sport. And I also on a bet, I managed to. We had this bet, and the challenge was to get an opportunity to say, at one point, "Terry Gross," and I did it. I did it.
Awesome.
I did it.
She didn't notice, probably.
She said. Well, she, at one point she asked a question, and this did not make it into the interview. She said, "Have you ever had a growth on your body or a rash or something that you just looked at yourself and you thought, how did I produce this disgusting thing?" And I'm like, this is it. And I went, Terry, gross. that was cut. That was cut.
That was cut.
That was cut.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. Terry. So what has changed in your approach to your material over time, over the books? I noticed this book, there's a lot of footnotes. It seemed more footnotes than...
Bonk holds the record for footnotes.
Bonk has the record for
footnotes. Bonk, the more footnotes there are, that's just a situation where there's so much fun material and I can't work it all in.
Yeah.
And there were just so many places where, like, this doesn't really belong in the chapter, but I'm putting it in anyway. So
right.
That's when it becomes a footnote.
I think the Beano visit and the jacket actually are in a footnote.
They are in a footnote. Yes, they are. They are
because
in a footnote.
Because that is too good to...
Yeah, the Beano windbreaker is in there. They also sponsored a hot air balloon race. Big balloon Beano.
That's somebody
that's
really working hard in publicity.
That is some creative marketing. That is going
really
on.
Good.
Yeah.
That is really good. So, but it doesn't really change how you approach it, or do you feel that you get more comfortable talking to scientists, or do you feel more like you research? You have even more facts at your disposal for each book, or
it gets easier in that people have heard of. I mean, and that could work. That could go in both directions. Mm-hmm. I was a little concerned that after Stiff came out, no one would want to speak to me just because, as a scientist, maybe you want someone to sort of take your work very seriously and be very thorough and present it in a lot of detail. And you don't really get that with me. you get what you get. But right. Anyway, but people have been now that more people are familiar with my work, they're like, oh yeah, Mary Roach, sure. You can come to the lab, which is always amazing to me that somebody would, even regardless of who I am, the fact that people are so, scientists are incredibly generous with their time, because mm-hmm. I'm not just interviewing them, I'm using them as unpaid tutors. Like, I'll sit down, you know, like for Packing for Mars, saying, okay, cosmic radiation, what is it? Mm-hmm. Where's it coming from? What, just start me at the beginning. You know, so it's hours later, these poor people.
Right. But, you know, not that many people ask them those questions.
That is also true. Their wives are so sick of hearing about it. They're so...
They're desperate to unload all of this knowledge,
yes.
In a way.
Yeah. I sat down. There was a guy for Gulp, Andres Vanderbilt, and he's a physicist, and he studied chewing and the forces of chewing, and which is more interesting than you'd think. And he's just so used to people like glazing over and walking away that he started talking about. He was telling me about how, you know, when if you're biting down on a peanut, and the second that the peanut gives way, your muscles cut out because if they kept pushing that hard, you'd break your teeth. So there's this automatic like cut off reflex that's amazing. And then he would stop himself and go, I don't know if you want to hear this. You know, it's just very like,
right.
Is this what you want to hear? Because yeah. He's so used to people going,
right. That's
oh,
a point
God,
which
Andres is going to talk about chewing again.
Yeah, right.
You know, but I'm like, wow, that is cool. Because people think that the jaw and the teeth are known for being super strong. Everyone's like, oh, pound for pound, the strongest muscle in the body, all that. But they're very sensitive. And so right. To me, it was fascinating that there's these really subtle, sensitive things going on under the radar, in your mouth all the time. So he was just, he was so excited, and you're coming all this way to talk to me? Like, what's the catch?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they must be proud that, you know, you're reading their work. I mean, they're publishing in these medical journals,
right.
So not a lot of circulation.
Right.
The general public isn't really aware of what they do, and you're able to, like, bring them, you know, to a larger audience.
Yeah. Yeah, for the most part, they're kind of tickled, which is nice.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. You know, as I read your book, I just wrote down notes. And I don't know if you know this or not, but it came to mind as I was reading Gulp.
Okay.
What is the nutritional value of human vomit? I don't know. It just came
Wait,
to mind.
Well, that's a silly question. It depends on what you ate. Depends
right.
on what you're throwing up.
Right. But you're mentioning...
What do you mean, like, would you get less nutrition having taken it into the stomach?
I guess how long
has it been in the stomach before you throw it
out?
I
didn't think it through, did I?
This is a... No. You're just raising more questions than I can answer.
But there is a portion of Gulp that I identified with very strongly, which was autocoprophagia.
Oh, okay. You're in the traditional value of shit. You're right. Asking. That's what you wanted to say.
Right. Well, I saw the shit, and then I thought, well, what is vomit? You know.
Vomit would have more nutritional value because it's been less broken down.
Right.
So, when a dog eats another dog's vomit, just basically just changed form. It's still it's very fresh and not broken down, and you wouldn't lose a lot of nutrients. It would be a little. The taste would be.
Right.
Altered a little.
But the autocoprophagia, you go into great detail about animals that eat their own feces and the feces of other animals.
Well,
how nutritious it actually really is, which was shocking.
That was, rodents, rabbits are famous shit eaters because,
worldwide.
They are eating it. As it comes out, as a matter of course, it is, and people who raise rabbits, it's not called coprophagia, they're called cecotrophs. They've given them a nice name.
Cecotrophs.
So there's the first round pellet, which is then eaten, and then there's the second round pellet. Mm-hmm. Because what's going on is that in the colon, the further breakdown is creating vitamins that the colon isn't set up to absorb. So the rabbit eats it again. And then it's like on the second run through, the small intestine can absorb it. So they if you prevent, how this all was discovered, there was this guy, Richard Henry Barnes, and he was studying nutrition. He was a Cornell nutritionist, and he was studying with rodents. Okay, and he was very frustrated by the menu substitutions of his rodents because they kept eating their shit. He's like, I don't want to study shit eating. I want to study this. So he prevented them by creating this little funny outfit.
It's like a little
leather jacket. But that's a whole other thing. But
it's a leather jacket, though, that the rodent wears.
It's a restraining. So anyway, he tried to prevent the rodents from eating their own pellets, and they became malnourished and they lost weight, and he realized for certain animals that's like a vitamin pellet.
Right.
You eat that.
Right.
You eat that. Yeah.
Right. No, I
and other animals as well.
the thing I also notice is that all the subjects you write about there is, you know, contemporary newsworthiness to some degree, but there is this incredible sort of swath of historical quackery that you love to go into in each one of these subjects, and it's bizarre to see how wrong scientists can be. Really,
how widespread the beliefs are.
Right. Give the example in Gulp of the guy who has the open stomach.
Oh, the fistulated stomach. Yeah,
right,
yeah, yeah.
Right.
But
that's fascinating.
What was the myth though?
It seemed just like an incredibly crude medical procedure, and the relationship between these two guys.
Right, right. Well, it was a trapper in 1822, is an 18-year-old fur trapper who was shot accidentally in his side. It blew open a hole in his stomach, and to his rescue comes the local army surgeon William Beaumont, there's a military garrison near the fur trading post. So he takes this boy in and thinks he's going to die. The boy survives. The hole doesn't heal entirely. It's what's called a gastrocutaneous fistula. It heals, but it heals open. And William Beaumont, a light bulb goes off at a certain point. William Beaumont is a man who, he's very driven career-wise. Mm-hmm. He's out, he's like some podunk military doctor, and he wants to make his name. And at one point he realizes, when the lad lies upon his side, I can peer into the hole and I can see human digestion in action. And then he gets the idea, if I got a little mesh bag on a silk string and I put different types of food into the stomach and I can see how long does it take to digest certain things, will they digest outside the body, does the weather affect it? I mean, for years and years, hundreds of experiments.
Right.
He ended up paying St. Martin for, he was sort of a houseboy slash digester machine. Other duties as assigned kind of
right.
thing. But it was actually not so much quackery as just kind of a create. I mean, given that Beaumont was not forced to do it, he was, St. Martin was paid. He wasn't held against his will. It was a kind of a creative approach to seeing what is going on inside the stomach. There had been researchers in the 1600s and Italian researchers who'd been curious about that. And the way they did it was to eat food themselves and then wait a while and make themselves throw up. So it's sort of bulimia in the service of science. So Beaumont was, he was getting at the same question. It was just, he realized this is a way to,
right.
Do it without throwing up.
But the fur trapper and the doctor, remained sort of medical partners for
30 years.
30
yeah, no,
years.
It was a very sort of coyote and roadrunner because St. Martin had a drinking problem. St. Martin would take off and disappear and, you know, then like go broke from drinking too much. And somebody would run into him and let Beaumont know. Of course, this was all by letters being carried. I mean, this is, you know, it wasn't by email. And then finally somebody would, you know, get a note to St. Martin saying, hey, he's offering you $500 to come and be his stomach again. And so he'd come back and then he'd run away again and Beaumont would be so pissed off. And Beaumont had this real sense of that, you know, that St. Martin should realize that it's his duty as an owner of a fistulated stomach, that he should see as his calling the furthering of science. Well, St. Martin was an illiterate fur trapper who's
right.
got a bunch of kids, and he doesn't give a crap about
science.
He's just
stomach.
He's got a hole in his stomach, and I think he's kind of like, well, fur trapping is pretty, it's hard labor being out, and, you know, the stomach thing, it's not pleasant. I don't really like Beaumont, but it's easier, and he's paying me, so you could see him kind of like going back and forth.
Yeah. Gets yeah. money to drink. No, that's like fascinating. So another person makes an appearance in Gulp. Elvis Presley.
Mm-hmm.
You write had a colon that was
yes.
2 to 3 times
yes.
larger than
it should have been.
Than it should have been.
Average person. He had a mega colon.
He had a mega, colon.
Elvis Presley struggled with constipation.
Right.
Seriously.
I mean, we don't think of that.
No.
You think of the swiveling of the hips. You don't think of a guy being constipated.
No, you don't. And it's unclear whether. Okay, I mean, he definitely had that condition, and he
right.
definitely died of a heart arrhythmia, straining on the toilet. But mm-hmm. what caused this condition, you know, the prescription drugs, I mean, it's on an amazing menu of prescription drugs and you know, painkillers will
right.
completely stop your gut, and psychiatric meds will also slow things down. So that wasn't helping. There's also thought he might have had something called Hirschsprung's, which is where a portion of your colon doesn't have any nerves, so it doesn't squeeze stuff along. So you get these backups and the colon stretches out, and when it stretches out, the muscles don't work right. So it kind of snowballs. And so, yeah, his motto was TCB,
right.
taking care of business,
right.
took on another kind of dimension. But it was, I spent a day with his doctor. Dr. Nick.
His doctor. That is such a great scene in your book. You're sitting in the living room of Elvis Presley's personal doctor
talking about constipation.
Yes. It's fascinating.
The house that Elvis gave him.
In
the 70s. And it was one of those scenes that just, his daughter was there and his wife. And every now and then, his wife was named Edna. And she didn't say very much, but at one point I said, did you ever talk to Priscilla about whether she knew whether Elvis as a boy had this problem, and he said, no, she didn't want to comment on that. And at one point, Edna said, she just goes and sticks her nose in everything. Just like out of the blue, a Priscilla Presley comment.
A little touchy. Touchy about it, yeah.
But anyway, it was an interesting afternoon.
I thought that was fascinating. So how is this book change your own diet and digestion? Have you thought about it? Do you think about it?
No, you know what this book, what happens with my books, has happened with Bonk, the sex lab book as well. There's a period of time when you're reading about the intricacies of the biological, physiological process, when you start to become aware of things that you don't want to be really aware of, either whether it's when you're having sex or when you're eating, whatever it is, you don't really want to think about yourself as an organism doing something.
Right.
And what's happening in your body. It's kind of distracting and strange.
That's why we have doctors.
Yes, right.
We don't have to think about it.
The oral processing in particular, because I'd come across a statistic like, the minimum number of chews required to ready a McVitie's digestive biscuit for swallow is 8. So I'd be like, I bet I can do it in 7. I think I can do it in 7. You know? So I just would be, or just conscious of like intraoral bolus rolling, or like, oh yeah, you do kind of, you put it up against the cheek and you roll it over.
What is intraoral bolus rolling?
Well, okay. It sounds like a sporting event.
It's in Canada.
Curling. It sounds like something
like
they
Canadian
do in the winter in Canada.
No offense to our friends from the north.
The bolus is, when you chew food and you take it apart and then you need to put it back together. You're putting it into the bolus. It's just a cylindrical saliva moistened mass.
It's cylindrical. It's not a ball.
No, it's not a ball.
I keep thinking bolus would be a round.
No, it's cylindrical.
Like a pencil.
Yeah.
Sort of,
yes.
Fatter.
Yes. Fatter, softer.
Fatter and softer. So that's every bite we swallow is a bolus.
You swallow a bolus, that's right.
I don't want to think about that.
No, sorry. Now you will.
I thought it was a little ball. That would be easy to kind of imagine going down, but
it's actually this tube
of mush.
Yeah. So there's the bolus that you...
So what is the intraoral?
Intraoral, just in the mouth. Inside
right.
the mouth. Inside
but you
the
kind
mouth.
Of roll it around as
so
we...
you're forming it. And there's really, really off-putting videos of this kind of stuff. And the journal articles for oral processing are just... There's one photo it's like four different photos over time. And the caption is like photos of spat-out custard to which black dye has been added. I mean, it's just... It is just the weirdest...
Yeah.
World.
It's kind of odd to just sit down for dinner and go, you know, never mind. You wouldn't even understand what I just saw today.
Yeah.
I saw a pair of Mylar fart collecting pants.
Flatestrapping pantaloons.
Yeah, that would be difficult to just sort of... When people ask you in the course of your research, what do you say? Well, how's the book going? What have you seen so far?
And, you know, I never talk about it because taken out, until the book is out,
right.
I don't really talk about it because taken out of context, it just sounds like dumb. It's weird and stupid, but all of these things, they're in the context of something that makes sense.
Right.
So they're almost too random and too, I don't talk about what I'm doing very much when I'm doing it.
But it's like they're like little silent victories you have. Silent, you get to silently champion something and enjoy just for yourself.
Well,
for the
and also, there's always that moment where you're familiar with this, where there's a moment in your reporting where you think, this is going to be so fun to write up. It's just going to be fun to write about.
Right.
And sometimes the most embarrassing and awkward things are the things that you know. I mean, even though it's embarrassing and awkward, like the bonk scene where I was a subject. In a sex study, that was really embarrassing and awkward, and I don't really recommend that to anybody as a way to spend mm-hmm. your afternoon, but I was at the time thinking this will be so yeah. fun to write this up.
Great material. This is going to be great
material. This is great material.
So what was that moment in Gulp where you realized this is going to be so fun to write?
I think the afternoon at Avenal State Prison with the Hoopers.
The Hoopers. Right.
The Hoopers.
So talk a little bit about that and why that's included in this. Because yeah. I think this is about the alimentary canal, and we're talking about prisoners shoving things up
okay.
their anus.
Yeah, it's a chapter. Well, it's the rectum chapter.
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
So I needed
Don't
some
fast forward. Start from the beginning.
I needed some kind of I wanted a kind of a narrative that would address the rectum, which is a storage facility. So the Hoopers are using the rectum for the purpose for which it evolved, which is it's a storage facility.
Right.
And also I wanted to talk about the defecation reflex, and which is something that you override all the time, that you can. And thank goodness for that you can override that reflex.
I thank God every day.
You should. Everybody should.
So, everybody should.
Everybody should be thankful for the manual override of the defecation reflex.
It would be a hell of a society if we didn't have that.
It would. There'd be bathrooms everywhere. And so I thought, okay, these guys who are packing stuff that way,
right.
And sometimes if you're detained for any under suspicion of smuggling, it's a test of wills. People caught in airports who are smuggling stuff using the alimentary canal as a criminal accomplice, they are having to really fight the urge. And they're, like, I was curious about what are the limits of that, and how is it that the body keeps, you know, does it ever burst? And so I had a lot of questions that these
right.
people could had a unique perspective
right.
upon.
So the prisoners. Let me think if I can remember this in the book. They smuggle things into prison.
Mm-hmm.
So their friend brings it in.
In the case of Avenal Prison, a lot of them work on it's a chicken farm, and so they are handed off egg shaped often tobacco bundles and sometimes cell phones, and then they hoop, and then they go back into the prison and kind of lay that stuff like the eggs they work with all day. So it's kind of
magical.
it was just to spend time. I mean, what a strange way to be introduced to someone. I mean, when I wrote to the public affairs office, I wrote to the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, and I said, I tried to explain myself as best I could. And I said, I'm interested in the alimentary canal as a criminal accomplice and smuggling contraband. And I got this note back, and he said, well, yeah, we have a big problem with cell phone smuggling at Avenal State Prison.
Because
gang leaders can do business from within. They can
right.
order hits or whatever they need to do
right.
on a cell phone. So they're not allowed to have cell phones. So, but the guy at the PR office said, because it's just a fact of life there, he said, yeah, sure, we can set you up with an interview with somebody who's quite known for this, and would 4 hours be enough time?
To talk about,
and I'm like, to talk to a stranger about his rectum? Yeah, I think so.
If you need more, we can get more,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and
it turned out prison is boring. Is the bottom line. And so for this, he's in for life. He was in for murder. And so some woman wants to talk about rectal smuggling. Yeah, sure. Why not? I don't know. Sure.
So can I ask you this? Did the interview go all 4 hours?
No.
No, it didn't.
No,
I think
it'd
run out of after a while.
Yeah, half an hour. I think it was 35 minutes. Covered the basics.
All right. Okay.
Thank you, audience. Thank you, Jack. Thank you, Mary.